This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Look out, this Rob and the team with the Who Wars podcast. The Alex and the Force, Blue Milk and Time Lords. It's the Who Wars podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast.
G'day everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 37. You know the drill by now, but I'll say it anyway. We really are the audio fanzine for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. So we do both. How are you? I've had a really great week, and it's really fun to be sitting here this weekend putting together all these great contributions from the Who Wars team. It's really, really something. But what I wanted to do just briefly at the start of the show here is rewind a little, because we've done an awful lot in the last couple of weeks and you may be unaware of some of it, so I'm just going to mention it here. In fact, if we go back to episode 36, that was a huge episode for Who Wars because, you know, in the past we've had people involved in Star Wars books and Doctor Who books, and we've had even people who've written Doctor Who episodes for television. We've had great comic book writers and artists, all sorts of people interviewed on Who Wars. But we'd never had a Doctor from either the classic era or the modern era of Doctor Who. And that was broken in episode 36. We broke the seal. We got Colin Baker, the sixth Doctor, on chatting with Andy. And that was just, to me, absolutely, positively huge. But you know what? Hot on the heels of that, we put out the Rivers of London special. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Rivers of London series. It's a series of novels written by Ben Aronovich. And the tie-in here to our show is that Ben Aronovich once wrote a couple of TV episodes of Doctor Who back in the 80s. He wrote Remembrance of the Daleks, possibly one of the best Dalek stories of classic era Who, I would say. And he also wrote a story called Battlefield, which was good. It was flawed in some places, could have been slightly better, but was very good as well. And his script editor at the time on Doctor Who was Andrew Cartmell. Now, Ben and Andrew have got together with Lee Sullivan, incidentally someone else we've interviewed on Who Wars in the past, who is a comic book artist, and they're now doing a Rivers of London comic series, which is what that special was all about. And I've got to say, I was really, really proud that that special was all about the Rivers of London comic series and didn't divert into, so Ben, when you wrote Remembrance of the Daleks, blah blah blah, or Andrew, what did it feel like to become the script editor of Doctor Who in 1987, blah 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 blah. No, we took on a more modern approach to that interview that Andy did, and I think it worked really well, even if it wasn't a Star Wars or Doctor Who topic per se. That's why we put it out as a special. Because I sometimes think what it must be like to be an actor or a musician or whatever, and you've done something great at some time in your life, something everyone loves, everyone remembers, and for decades after, people only want to talk about that. I'm sure it must become quite frustrating at times because you've done things that you think might be just as good or even better, but no one acknowledges them. They just want to talk about the old stuff. And I think that could be quite annoying. So I do like to see, and I do like to listen to interviews where people don't always hark back to the past with people. They do want to talk about their new album or their new movie and sort of understand where that person's head is at here in 2015, rather than asking them constant questions about things that happened in the 1980s. Things, it must be said as well, that people have spoken about many, many times before on podcasts and in magazines and in books and all sorts of things. So do check out that special if you haven't. And if you haven't read the books, the best way I can describe them is think of a UK cop show, but throw in a bit of magic. That's a very quick, broad brushstrokes way of describing it. But if you like a bit of magic, if you like a bit of the Harry Potter in your life, but you also like UK cop shows, Rivers of London might be right up your alley. I don't know. Anyway, do give it a try if that sounds interesting. Something else that came up, and this wasn't a podcast, it's a blog on our whowars.net website, is I unboxed one of the new Robert Harrop Cybermen figurines. Now, if you've looked at our website in the past, you may have seen me unbox a Fourth Doctor figurine from Robert Harrop. This is a UK company that their claim to fame is a series of dog figurines, but they're dogs wearing human clothes and in sort of human poses. I guess what they call that, anthropomorphic sort of poses for these dogs. And they're quite cute, but they're now doing this Doctor Who range, and so far it's focused on the classic era, which is just amazing because it is rarer to see classic era Doctor Who merchandise, particularly sort of high quality stuff like this. These are, you know, hand sculpted out of, you know, wax originally, and then they're hand pulled from molds. They're some sort of ceramic, and then they're hand painted. It's a very small cottage industry in the UK that this is coming from, and I'm just over the moon with them. They're not everyone's cup of tea. Some people do prefer, I think, more of a, you know, a 3D scan and, you know, perfectly smooth plastic replicas, more like toys perhaps. But I'm wrapped with these figurines, and as I say, I've put out this Cyberman unboxing on the blog. If you're into Cyberman or you're into figurines, if you're a Doctor Who fan, do look up whowars.net and have a look at that post, because I do go into quite some detail with the figurine, photographing it from all different sides and so on, and you may really like it. And then, of course, I have to add, last weekend we had the Cloud City Council popping out issue 23 of their show, which, as always, is a great listen for the Star Wars fans out there, as they talk about Star Wars in general and Star Wars games and Star Wars comics and all that sort of good stuff. And now here we are a week on, and we're into the next episode of Who Wars. So look, without any further ado, that was just a brief overview of things we've done recently, things you may have missed, because we have pumped out some fun stuff in the past fortnight. And I wouldn't like you to miss out on it if you're into those topics. And there you go. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this episode. We've got all sorts of interesting stuff, including a sort of a comedy skit from Neil and Johnny from the Drinking in the Park podcast. Now, there's a name you might not have heard before. And they're going to talk to us about the long-held links between the Muppets and Star Wars. That's quite an interesting little segment. Something very different and new for Who Wars. We've got Kate talking to Margaret Mays, one of her friends who was at San Diego Comic Con, about her experiences there. Margaret's a Star Wars and Doctor Who fan, as well as many other genre shows as well, it must be said. And aside from that, all sorts of reviews and features and great things coming up. I particularly like where the Cloud City guys get down and look at the original Dalek story from Doctor Who from 1963. So these chaps who you normally hear talking about Star Wars are going to sit down and talk about a 50-year-old plus black and white Doctor Who episode. So stay tuned for that as well. As I say, all sorts of good stuff. You're very welcome at Who Wars.
It's one of California's most exciting cities, packing in more activities per square mile than perhaps any other place in the world. Get ready, because we're going to San Diego for the weekend.
All right, so welcome to Who Wars, Margaret.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. So we like to start with the question, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
I'm going to have to go Star Wars.
Yeah, I had a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big Doctor Who fan, but definitely Star Wars all the way for me.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about each of them, probably a little more about Star Wars. But so just to give people a little bit of a background, I met you on Twitter before Star Wars Celebration, and then we met at Star Wars Celebration with Team Hoojib.
Go Team Hoojib.
I know, right? I know. We need to do like a segment about Hoojibs or something sometime, I think.
Oh, yeah, that would be good.
That'd be really funny. But yeah, so we met then, and then I noticed from your tweets that you were going to be attending San Diego Comic Con. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So you're from San Diego, right?
Yeah, I live in San Diego.
Awesome.
I've been going to San Diego Comic Con for years.
Awesome. Do you know, like, how many times you've been?
Probably 8, maybe.
So do you remember going when it was not as big of a deal as it is now?
Yeah, it was already pretty big when I started going. It would sell out, but it wouldn't sell out until like a month before, you know?
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, now it sells out essentially the second that they go on sale.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was already pretty big when I started going.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about your Doctor Who experience at San Diego Comic-Con.
To go back to Doctor Who or Star Wars, I had to sacrifice the Doctor Who panel to get in line for Star Wars, because that panel was on Thursday, and I knew if I got in line after that panel was over, that it would be, that would be too late in the afternoon.
Yeah, you always have to make sacrifices at cons.
You do, and I really, I mean, Star Wars hadn't had a Hall H panel in, I think, about 6 years, so I was definitely, that was my thing this year. I was getting into that panel. But I did go see Peter Capaldi was the guest at the Nerdist live taping they did Saturday night, so I went and saw that. So that was my little bit of Doctor Who.
That's cool.
That I got during the convention.
So with Peter Capaldi, I'm curious, what was the fan reaction to him?
Well, they love him. I mean, the Nerdist following is pretty, you know, Doctor Who, you know, pretty into Doctor Who anyway. And he usually has a Doctor Who guest each year. So, yeah, I mean, everyone loved him. And he was just such a great interview. I mean, he didn't really, he talked a little bit about Doctor Who, but also talked just a lot about himself. And he is really interesting.
So have you watched the trailer for the new season of Doctor Who?
No, I haven't watched it yet. I'm still trying to get caught up on everything that I didn't see.
It looks really cool.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's supposed to start in September, is that right?
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so why don't we go on to the Force Awakens panel. Is that what it was called, the Force Awakens? Or was it just like Star Wars?
No, it was the Force Awakens panel.
Okay. So when did you have to get in line for the infamous Hall H?
I got in line on, so the panel was Friday at 5:30, I think is when it started. I got in line Thursday at 1. So, and I knew, because some friends of mine that had camped out for Doctor Who on Wednesday night had texted me photos and were like, here's the line for Star Wars on Friday. So I knew that a line had already started. But yeah, when I got in line at 1, I thought, oh, I'll probably, you know, I'm not going to be near the front, but it was way longer than I thought it was going to be already at 1 o'clock. So I'm not exactly sure at what point it reached the capacity of the room, but they handed out, starting at 8:30 that night, they handed out wristbands, and I know they handed out all of them at that point. So, I mean, people, I mean, the room had already been filled by 8:30-ish when they start handing those out.
So do you have any tips for survival?
One is immune boosters. I'm big on taking immune boosters before, during, and after. One is snacks and to stay hydrated, because that's one of the, it's just such an intense experience of sleep deprivation, not nutritious food, you know, dehydration. You're just trying to get to everything, see everything, and then just know that you're not going to be able to see everything. So just have a plan B when you, I mean, I kind of in the back of my mind was like, oh, if I don't get into the Force Awakens, I'm going to do some of the smaller Star Wars panels that they have on Friday. But I really did not want that to be the case, but you always have to have sort of a backup plan of if I don't get into this, this would be fun too.
Yeah. So while you were waiting in line in the Force Awakens panel line, do you have any favorite moments that stick out?
Not really. It was pretty tame crowd. I had brought sunscreen and then forgot it. So I guess I didn't bring it. I bought it, just forgot it. And then so I just kind of had my head buried in a book trying to stay out of the sun. And then in the morning, they bought, because I know at Celebration, I don't know, at the panel, they had bought pizzas for the line the night before. This time in the morning, they had bought coffee and donuts for the line. Yeah, it didn't make it to the end of the line, but I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I remember the pizza that JJ got everyone at Anaheim.
Same sort of thing, cool. Except it's morning donuts.
Nice. All right, so let's talk about that panel then. So I was kind of trying to live tweet it, but I was on vacation, and I haven't actually watched it yet. So can you give us an overview of what was included in the panel?
Yeah, it started with, they brought out, Chris Hardwick moderated it, and they brought out J.J. Abrams, Kathleen Kennedy, and Lawrence Kasdan. And he did a little bit of Q&A with them, talked to them for a few minutes. They brought out the character, Baba Joe. And he walked around on stage and they talked about kind of how he worked. And, you know, it took five puppeteers to operate him and that. And he looked like he could fall off the stage at any second. And but was super, I mean, it was just amazing to see that. You know, similar to when BB-8 rolled out at the celebration panel.
Cool.
And then they showed some, they showed the production video. I hope I'm getting all of this in the right
order. Oh, yeah, I have watched that.
That was, Mark Hamill was narrating it. I started tearing up. No, yeah. I'm not going to lie. And then they brought out Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and Oscar Isaacs, and did a little bit of Q&A with them. So they were, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so. Then they brought out Adam Driver, Gwendolyn Christie, and Domhnall Gleeson.
Nice.
And did a little Q&A with them. And they did it a little different, because usually they do audience Q&A all at the end. Mm-hmm. And they sort of did a couple instead of doing a bunch of questions at the end, they did a couple questions like at each segment of bringing out new cast members. So that was kind of nice to break that up a little bit. And then they brought out Carrie Fisher. And so talked to her, you know, by herself
for
a while.
Was Gary there? Her dog?
He was not on stage,
aww.
No. I did see pictures at the concert that she had either tweeted or that had been posted. And she did have, him with her there.
Cool.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that until you just said that. No, he wasn't there. And so then talked to her for a few minutes, and then they brought out Mark Hamill, and they talked to him for a few minutes. And then, you know, at that point, all of the microphones were gone on the table, which is oftentimes a Comic-Con misdirect.
Yeah.
So then eventually they announced that Harrison Ford was also there, and he came out, and they did some Q&A with him. And yeah, that's, again, crying again at that point.
Yeah, I remember I was on Twitter at that point, and I was like,
Yeah, that was, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had thought, okay, they're going to show a trailer, and they're going to have Harrison Ford there. And then a couple days before Comic-Con started, Star Wars had announced that there wouldn't be a trailer. And I was like, well, they're going to show something. You don't have a Hall H panel and not show anything. So I had both of my needs were met. I got some video footage and I got Harrison Ford.
Sweet. So what was your favorite part of the panel?
Seeing Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
On top of just seeing Harrison Ford, because I was kind of prepared for a, you know, curmudgeon-y Harrison Ford. He hasn't historically been super embracing of the Star Wars phenomena. But to see him on stage and seem genuinely happy to be there and really touched by everyone being there was really, I mean, that was just an added, you know, added excitement
to
it.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really nice to, I think, you know, it seemed genuine. I think he maybe has come around now.
He's like, yeah, those fans are not too bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I guess this isn't, you know, this isn't all too bad.
That made me so sad that he wasn't at Celebration.
Yeah, because I had really thought he was going to be at Celebration, because I know he had just gotten in the accident,
right.
But I think he'd been out of the hospital a couple of weeks,
I wonder
so
about...
I thought, maybe they'll have him.
Yeah.
And then when they didn't, I was like, they'll have him at San Diego.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad he's okay and was able to do that at San Diego at least, though.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. So tell us about this surprise concert then.
So the surprise concert pretty much blew my mind. The panel started wrapping up. You know, they talked to Harrison Ford for a few minutes. And then, you know, I think it was Chris Hardwick, it was either Chris Hardwick or JJ, and was like, I don't know, I don't really feel like we should leave it here. And, you know, this seems like a weird place to end it. And J.J. Abrams was like, who likes Star Wars music here? And so everyone, of course, you know, was raising their hand and screaming. And so then he announced that there was going to be a surprise concert and that everyone was invited. And the funny thing, he's just kind of started laughing. It's like, I cannot believe the city of San Diego is about to let us do this. And he's like, so we're all going to get up and we're going to walk in a nice orderly fashion to another venue to see a concert.
Sweet.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I was, by then I had pretty much lost my mind.
It was just the people in Hall H who got to go?
Yeah. Yeah. It was okay. Just the people in Hall H. And then, you know, I was kind of, you know, we were sitting about halfway back in the room, so we could see the stage, but we had to rely on the video monitors because we were far enough back where you couldn't actually see what was happening up there. Because that room holds about 6,500 people. So when you're in the back, you can't see the stage from the back of the room. Mm-hmm. So we were sitting about halfway back, but we were sitting right where they started filing people out for the concert. So we were in with the first, you know, wave of people at the venue. So we got like right up front, which was nice.
So which lightsaber color did you get?
I picked blue.
Nice. So everybody got a lightsaber, right?
Yeah, everyone's badge had a little tear-off thing at the bottom of it that was redeemable for a lightsaber.
Oh, that is such a cool keepsake to have.
Yeah, each time it was like, you know, at the end of the panel I was satisfied, and then it's like, oh, I get to go to a Star Wars concert? Wow, this is even better. And then it was like, oh, I get a lightsaber? Oh, it gets even better.
That's so cool. Those pictures, I was like, the people that were tweeting the pictures from that, those are so cool.
Yeah.
All the lightsabers and,
it was amazing. You know, I mean, I can't, they had, you know, they were filming it too. So, I mean, it was so beautiful with that many
so
people cool. with lightsabers. It's, we were so close that we couldn't really see how it looked with everyone having them. But
so about how long was the concert then?
Well, I thought it was about an hour. I read somewhere it was a half an hour. Uh-huh. I think it was maybe somewhere in between there. We ended up leaving, it was over by 9 and the panel got out at 6:30, but it took a long time to walk everyone over and get the venue filled.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was probably close to an hour.
So it had like the classics, I'm sure, like the main theme and the Imperial March. And was there anything else that stood out to you?
Oh gosh. honestly, I can't even, there was, the piece, and I don't know the pieces by name, I'm sorry, with the Ewoks, and that was pretty
fun. Like the celebration at the end?
No, not the celebration, but just sort of the music from Endor.
Oh, okay.
With a lot of the Ewoks.
That's so awesome.
And because they had video projection, too, that was going on at the same time. So there was one screen, like, behind the symphony, and then there were two, like, screens flanking the stage.
Cool.
So they were showing, like, clips from the movies and stuff, too.
Oh, I heard there was a message from John Williams, too?
Yeah, there was a video message that was, it was definitely pre-recorded. I don't think it was live, but it was definitely specific to the concert.
Cool. That's and, so awesome.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I could not have expected, I mean, it was just more than you could possibly expect. It was just so above and beyond.
So if you had to describe the Force Awakens panel experience in one word, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, in one word.
How about a sentence?
How about tremendous?
That works. Awesome.
Yeah, I would say mind-blowing, but that's two words.
You can hyphenate it. All right, so I wanted to talk just a little bit about San Diego Comic-Con in general. So, like, one of the main features of Comic-Cons anywhere is the cosplay. So did you cosplay at all this time?
I did not. I usually don't because it's just so intense. And to me, I need to be comfortable all day long. So
I understand.
A t-shirt is my uniform usually. and, you know, I didn't... And it may just be a product of like that I spent most of Thursday in line and I spent all of Friday in Hall H, but I feel like I didn't quite see as much Star Wars cosplay as normal. Although I did see a lot of photos on Twitter of a lot of people dressed as Rey. So,
oh, that's cool.
So it may just have been that I didn't see as much of it as usual.
Yeah. Did you see any other interesting cosplay? Like,
I saw on Saturday morning, I was over at one of the hotels, and I saw a great Anakin and Padme from Attack of the Clones. Yeah, and she had the yellow dress on, and they both...
I love that one.
Yeah, it looked really good, too. Cool. So that was a really good Star Wars one. And did I don't... Trying to think, I don't think I saw a lot of Doctor Who cosplay. I just didn't see a lot of cosplay this year, and I can't believe that it wasn't there. I think I just didn't see it. And a lot of times at San Diego, because it's so big and so diverse, a lot of times there's cosplay that's like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, that's true.
I did see a girl on Sunday that had a Doctor Who dress on. It was like a TARDIS fabric that was really cute. Yeah, it was actually, I think she must have made it, but yeah, I wanted to ask her where she got that fabric.
So did you see any interesting non-Star Wars or Doctor Who related cosplay? Like at Phoenix Comic Con, there was a ton of Deadpools. Like, that was the big thing.
Oh, you know, and I didn't see any of that, but somebody else was talking about a lot of Deadpool, that they had seen a lot of Deadpool cosplay.
Guardians of the Galaxy was pretty big, too.
Yeah, and I don't think I saw any Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was just all in the wrong place. I mean, I'm trying to, I mean, other years I've seen tons of great stuff, and but I just feel like I didn't really see that much of it this year.
Yeah.
But I think some of that too is that I was in line and in panels most of the time. So.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So how would you rank this San Diego Comic-Con compared to past years?
For my needs, it was absolutely hands down the best one.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I could not have asked for a better Star Wars experience. That it's definitely, I mean, every Comic-Con is fun, but for me, that was, that Star Wars panel and that concert was more than I could have ever expected.
So how does San Diego Comic-Con compare to other cons that you've gone to then? Like Celebration, for example?
It's different than Celebration. I would say I'd prefer Celebration if that was available to me every year. Because it's a little smaller, it's a little less intense, and it's all Star Wars.
Yeah.
But Sandy, it's got a lot to offer. I mean, it kind of pulls at all of my fandoms. You know, I like Doctor Who, I like Harry Potter, I like Lord of the Rings, I like The Walking Dead, I like Game of Thrones. So it's just, you know, sensory overload.
Yeah.
So it has a lot to offer. So it is really great in that respect.
Oh, I meant to ask you earlier about the Force Awakens panel. Uh-huh. How did the crowd reaction, like, how was that comparable to when you saw it at Star Wars Celebration?
It was way more intense at Celebration.
Yeah.
I mean, I left that panel at Celebration deaf because people were screaming, so including myself.
I know, I wasn't so even in that main room either.
but with San Diego, they don't clear their rooms in between panels.
Oh.
So because they have so much programming and that room takes over an hour to fill. And probably close to that to empty. So they just have programming that's back to back to back.
Wow.
So not everyone that's in there is a hardcore Star Wars fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were people that were in there because on Friday during the day, there was Walking Dead was in the morning. Game of Thrones was in the afternoon. So there were people that were there for those panels, but mm-hmm. stayed because they like Star Wars. So the people that I was sitting next to were there for Game of Thrones. So it wasn't quite as crazy excited as it is at Celebration, but it was definitely everyone was excited to be there. There wasn't quite as much screaming, but it was close.
What are your future con plans then?
Oh, well, every year I hope to get San Diego Comic-Con tickets.
Yeah.
So I hope to do that again next year.
When did they go on sale?
They go on sale. They usually do a pre-registration in the fall. So if you attended the year before, you know, you have a badge code number that you can try to register. But, you know, that again is they don't sell as many tickets as people want to get them. So that's kind of a luck of the draw. Mm-hmm. And then they'll do a general admin sale in the spring usually. But yeah, and then I may do WonderCon this year.
Where's that at?
Which is, it used to be in Anaheim this year. It's going to be at the Los Angeles Convention Center.
Oh, okay.
And it's put on by the same people that do San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, just
is as that just a, smaller than?
Yeah, it's a lot smaller. And it's only Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I went, this year was the first time I'd gone, and I went on Sunday because I just wanted to scope out the convention center, the Anaheim Convention Center for Celebration. I wanted to kind of see where everything was located and check out where's my hotel going to be, you know, all that kind of stuff.
That's
so
cool.
I did a little recon mission to that. And yeah, it was fun. So I would go back to that one.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, thanks for being on the show, Margaret.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And be sure to follow Margaret on Twitter at Meg Mays. Until we meet again, I guess, right?
All right, yeah. All right. We'll see you at a convention sometime soon, hopefully.
Sweet. All right. Allons-y, and may the force be with you.
You too.
Thanks.
And now, Pigs in Space! The last time we saw the spaceship Swine Trek, we hoped it would be the last time. But it's back.
3PO. Activate the Navi computer.
Yeah. I'm not awfully keen on this spaceship, Master Luke. It's so messy. Cakes, half-eaten sandwiches.
Oh, will you stop? You don't hear R2 complaining, do you?
Yes, I do. He just said it's like a pigsty.
Hey, what's going on here? I'm Captain Link Hogthrob, and this is my spaceship.
That explains everything.
Why don't you let me explain? I'm Luke Skywalker. My friends and I have just borrowed your spaceship so we can rescue our friend, Chewbacca the Wookiee.
Hey, everybody, for the Who Wars podcast, this is DJ Johnny Rock and my good friend, Neil Young.
Hi, it's Neil. I'm Johnny's best friend in the world.
He's my friend. He's my close
We're
personal... No.
Best friend.
We're friends. We're friends. We're good friends.
Yep.
Yep. So today we're going to talk about a very important issue, I think, to Star Wars fans. With the conglomeration and the association and the purchasization of the Muppets by Disney.
Those are great words, Johnny. First of all, I just am really impressed at the way you're expanding your vocabulary.
It's all about, you know, just looking in a dictionary and finding out information.
So. Yeah, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, sorry, what were you saying about...
I was saying, you know, Disney owns everything now. They own Star Wars... And they own the Muppets. Two things that we want to bring together today on the Who Wars podcast.
Definitely. Definitely. Well,
there's a lot of associations between the Muppets and Star Wars. Not a lot of people think about this, but the Muppets actually have a really long, ongoing history with Star Wars. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Totally. Well, first of all, of course, there's the obvious connection that Frank Oz, Jim Henson's right-hand man, who we've talked about before... And the co-director of great films like The Dark Crystal, the director of films like The Muppets Take Manhattan,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, this genius of the silver screen who performed Fozzie Bear, Miss Piggy, of course, he performed Yoda. And many people don't know that Jim Henson was originally the man who was scheduled to perform Yoda.
No way.
But he couldn't do it.
Why
because
not?
Of a previous obligation. He was developing his own projects.
Previous obligation. That sounds like he couldn't be bothered.
I know, but it wasn't. So he's told George Lucas, he said, I'll give you the person who is my replacement, the only person I'd put in my place, and that was Frank Oz.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
And was this the first main association between... The Jim Henson, I guess, company at that time?
Yeah.
And Star Wars? Oh.
It was, but the Jim Henson company didn't build the puppets for the Star Wars franchise.
Oh.
That was Lucasfilm and his enterprise. He did that all himself. But all of those creatures, the Jabba the Hutt creature, that was a giant puppet
mm-hmm.
controlled by a bunch of different people. So very much in the spirit of the Muppets.
It's fascinating. And so what other Muppet Star Wars crossovers are there? I understand there's been a few of them, right?
There's been a few of them. First of all, there's the great episode of the Muppets with Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker himself.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And Chewbacca and Anthony Daniels playing C-3PO and R2-D2. And they made an appearance on the Muppet Show as the characters from Star Wars. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, for the time, I mean, they were like superstars, right?
If they were on the Muppets, they still are superstars. Johnny, they still are superstars.
What, the Muppets are superstars?
Yes, the Muppets are still superstars, but the cast of Star Wars will always be superstars. Let's just not split hairs here, Johnny. Okay. I mean,
I'm not arguing with
well,
you.
Well, you're arguing a little. You said they were superstars.
Well, they were superstars.
No, they were superstars. I'm saying they still are.
Well,
Johnny, they still are superstars.
Well,
okay?
I don't know. I mean...
Yes, yes. Just because you don't know doesn't mean it's not true, Johnny.
Listen,
I don't mean to get rude with you, but there's a lot of things you don't know.
You're getting a little bit agitated.
Well, I'm passionate about this, Johnny. You know this about me.
I know you love your puppets, but don't
I love my puppets.
Away, okay? Don't
I have puppets.
Away. All right.
I love my puppets.
And
yes.
You love your Star Wars.
I love my Star Wars.
I get that. So are we going to get any Muppet treats in the new movies? You know anything about this? Any inside information there?
No. But let's talk a little bit about Gonzo dressed as Darth Vader. Wow, what a great idea
when
that was.
When did he do that? When did he do that?
In that episode with Mark Hamill.
Okay.
He comes forward and you kind of know it's Gonzo already. But then he turns his head to the side and you see his nose in the Darth Vader.
That really gives it away, doesn't it?
Funny, Johnny.
Now, one little beef that I have about the Muppets and about Star Wars is we did not get the awesome crossover that I was expecting and felt very ripped off by when I was watching Muppets from Space on Netflix last week. There was very little space in Muppets from Space.
Johnny, again, and
no
I'm sorry
Wars,
to
no
say
Star
this.
No Star Wars references, really.
Listen, I'm sorry to say this to my best friend.
Friend.
But you really don't know what you're talking about here.
Why do you always say
you
that?
You don't know what you're... If you want crossover, I have crossover.
Okay, give me crossover.
I'll give you crossover.
Okay, go.
I'm going to say one word to you, Johnny.
Well, how will it be a crossover if it's one word?
Labyrinth. Labyrinth, Johnny.
It's a maze. Yeah.
The film... No, Johnny, the
it's
film directed... No.
Usually with a monitor or something
yes,
in the middle of it.
Well, yeah, but I'm not talking... I'm talking about the movie directed by Jim Henson himself. Labyrinth with David Bowie.
I never
with a young, beautiful, gorgeous, stunning Jennifer Connelly.
You almost forgot her name there, didn't you?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
What's because when I saw the movie, I was just a boy. I was smitten. I was smitten. And then when I saw Requiem for a Dream, I was just totally destroyed and mortified because that's a very... very vile, vulgar movie.
I know nothing of either of these films. What is The Labyrinth all about?
Well, The Labyrinth was a crossover between George Lucas and Jim Henson. George Lucas was the producer of The Labyrinth, Johnny.
Oh.
And he was on the set monitoring Jim Henson's direction.
Monitoring, like, the monitor in The Labyrinth or monitoring, like, a computer monitor?
Sort of like both, actually. He was keeping an eye on the progress and the program and making sure Jim Henson wasn't wasting all of his valuable money and time.
Right.
You know, because when you've got an incredibly inventive mind like Jim Henson, you can only imagine the unbelievable things that he might try to bring into reality.
I can believe that. I mean, Jim Henson was a true artistic visionary. I mean... a guy who does not have any time, zero time to shave at all, which clearly is the case or was the case with Jim Henson, he must have all kinds of magical ideas in his mind if this guy can't even like find the time to get a razor and some soap on his face.
Johnny.
I'm not speaking ill of the dead. I'm just saying.
No, Johnny.
I'm just
this
saying.
This is a serious topic.
I know. And that's why I'm being serious
excuse
here.
Excuse me. I want to put a message out there because this affects me personally,
okay.
Johnny.
All right.
Just give me a moment. To address...
Yeah, I'll let you talk.
Let me talk, Johnny.
I'm going to let you talk.
Without being interrupted.
I'm not interrupting you.
I'm sorry, Johnny.
You can talk now.
You're bringing up a lot of issues that I'm very passionate about.
Okay, talk about them. Go.
Okay.
You always talk about how you want to talk, but then you don't talk.
Because you aren't letting me talk, Johnny.
I am letting you talk.
Let me talk. Okay, so.
Okay, talk if you want.
I'm trying to talk, Johnny. You keep interrupting me like you just did. Let me talk, please.
Okay, go.
All right. To all acne sufferers out there, I feel your pain. I've had acne, not just, well, I'll admit it, not just on my face, but all over my body. And I know that those products that they sell, OxyPads, none of it really works, especially when you have to wear shirts and pants all day. The heat builds up, you start chafing, and the pimples, they just erupt. They just arrive on your body. I feel your pain. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up, Johnny...
I'm curious.
...is because you mentioned Jim Henson not shaving.
Yeah, I did.
You said you weren't going to speak ill of the dead.
I'm not breaking new ground
the
here.
The reason
He's
why...
He's got a beard, I mean...
I know he has a beard, Johnny. Would you let me finish my story? Jim Henson...
Go ahead, then. Talk.
I'm trying to talk, Johnny. You're not letting me talk. I want to get my story across, and you're making me upset.
Don't cry.
You're making me upset, Johnny. It's a serious topic for me.
Maybe you're being a baby.
No, I'm not being a baby. I just want to talk.
Okay, talk. Go. Talk about the Muppets.
Jim Henson suffered.
Tell the people. Go ahead.
Oh, Johnny.
Sorry.
Oh, God. This is horrible. We can't air this. We can't put this on the air.
We're not going to. Who Wars Podcast is going to do it?
Oh, no. They can't do it. We have to edit all this out.
What's your thesis here?
Jim Henson suffered from acne in his youth, and that left pockmarks on his face. And because of the marks on his face, I'm even emotional talking about it now. He grew a beard to hide the marks on his face, and that's a true story.
Is there a deeper meaning here? Perhaps he was a man scarred who was hiding behind puppets?
Absolutely. I think that definitely. You know, my therapist says, the child therapist that my mom has had me going to see since I was three, he always used to, because I deal with a lot of abandonment issues now that my father is gone.
Yeah.
Though he's coming back. But
he's alive, but yeah, he left you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gave up.
Yeah. So anyway, basically I talk it out with puppets between my child therapist and myself. I have a puppet and his name is Johnny, actually.
His name is Johnny?
Yeah. What are you doing? What are you doing going into my room?
Oh, sorry. I was just going to take a nap. You were talking for a really
long
time.
My mom's taking a nap in there, and we're being too loud as it is.
No, she's okay. I checked on her. She's good.
Why are you checking on my mom?
To make sure she's okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, thanks, Johnny.
You're welcome. I was just adjusting her pillow for her.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know a lot about the Muppets. Thanks for sharing all of your Muppet... you know, information and stuff.
Well, thanks for finally letting me, Johnny.
You're welcome. You need to talk too. And, you know, I do realize that. But, you know, sometimes it's good for you to have, like, an opinion too. Because people don't just want to hear me talking all the time. They also like to hear you talking because you have ideas and thoughts of your own.
Sometimes
that you like to, you know, get out there into the world.
Sometimes.
Because, you know, your thoughts are important too.
Sometimes.
And that's why you need to talk also. So thank you for sharing.
Well, thanks.
You know, all of your relevant information and stuff. Because without you, we wouldn't know all this stuff about Muppets. Who aren't just puppets, they're Muppets.
Yeah, there's a mix between...
Yeah, like half puppet and half Muppet.
No, half puppet and half marionette.
What's the idea? What's a marionette?
A marionette is another type of puppet that is operated from above on strings.
Why would you want to do that? You'd see the strings.
No, but you see, the Muppets, they used to have these poles that moved their arms, some of them. So that was a kind of... So it was a mix between a puppet and a marionette, and you put them together, you get Muppet. Or marionette and puppet, Muppet.
Why do I let you talk so much?
Well, Johnny, I appreciate it. And I have to say, I apologize for breaking down a little bit. I didn't take some of my medication today. And, thank you for letting me speak, and I apologize for getting angry at you, Johnny. You're my best friend, and I shouldn't treat you like that.
You know what? It's okay. I'll let you go. You know, I'll let you go on this particular issue because I can see that you're very emotional right now, and you're fragile. You're like a puppet.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It would have been more appropriate and meaningful if you'd say I was like a Muppet, but that's okay, Johnny.
That's what I said, okay. A puppet, a Muppet, whatever. It's the same thing.
No, they're not the same thing, Johnny.
Right, right. One of them's got a strings on it, right?
No, a puppet can be many different things anyway. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, thanks. So thanks for listening, and thanks for learning all about puppets and their association with Star Wars.
I love Muppets.
Brace yourselves, listeners, for a segment 7 years in the making. Right now, and for many episodes to come, Rob is watching the Clone Wars.
Yes, here we are for another installment of Rob Watches the Clone Wars. If you've been playing along at home, you'll know that we've already looked at a number of episodes. We're looking at them in chronological order. So we've looked at episodes from Season 2, Season 1, the Clone Wars theatrical film, Season 3. And here we are back in Season 1 for Episodes 2, 3, and 4, which are all linked. And you can, I think, tell that by the titles of Rising Malevolence, Shadow of Malevolence, and Destroy Malevolence. If you're a keen Clone Wars viewer, I'm sure you've seen these at least once, if not more. So without any further ado, let's get into talking about them. Rising Malevolence is the first of the three, and in this one, there's a separatist mystery weapon which is terrorizing the clone Starfleet. And indeed, we see the power of this mystery weapon. The mystery weapon turns out to be an ion cannon, of all things, knocking out a number of capital ships. Jedi Master Plo Koon is on one of them, and after it knocks these ships out, it destroys them very handily. I mean, this is a massive, massive ship, the Malevolence. And you then have Plo Koon and a number of clones in escape pods floating out in space. And this is where the episode gets quite scary right from the outset, because the Separatists send out a little ship with some droids on it to basically start dismantling the escape pods. And we see this first through an escape pod that's already been dismantled, and you can see there's no atmosphere inside. I think there's even a body hanging outside of the escape pod, and you think, oh gosh, that's terrible. And then not long after in the episode, you actually see it being done. You see the droids cutting into an escape pod, and clones literally being sucked out of it and out into the vacuum of space to die. And I was thinking, one, gosh, I don't remember watching this in Season 1. I must have put it out of my head, or maybe I missed it or something, because this is quite dark stuff. And I didn't think the darker stuff started in Clone Wars until later in the run. But no, you have this first episode where it's a very tense situation, where Plo Koon and his clone troopers are sitting in a pod, basically waiting for this ship to turn up and to cut their pod open and kill them. And that's quite a scary premise. In fact, I'll say it here at the outset of this review of the three episodes, I think these three episodes, plus a little padding, could perhaps have been a better theatrical film than the one that was actually released. I mean, when I looked at the theatrical film, I was making the comment that, you know, this is basically like a few episodes of Clone Wars stitched together, which might have been better as single episodes. Here, I think the three episodes together, again, with a little bit of padding, maybe with a little bit of rejigging of how the story works out, would have been a really, really excellent movie. But we'll get onto that more later. Moving on to Shadow of Malevolence, this is the episode where, you know, Plo Koon has been rescued with his clone troopers, they're back at the fleet, and Anakin decides to take some Y-Wing bombers. These are very new Y-Wing bombers. They look a little different to the ones we know from A New Hope, but it's where the Y-Wing model started, I guess. And he decides he's going to lead a strike on the Malevolence, because the ion cannon can knock out capital ships, but, you know, smaller craft will be able to avoid it. And he hopes to get the squadron up there to knock out the Malevolence, particularly by bombing its control deck. And that's a very exciting sort of mission. And it's here in this episode. I mean, this is present in all Clone Wars episodes, the callbacks to A New Hope. Indeed, in the first of the three episodes here, I noticed when they were firing the ion cannon, they had a couple of droids up near where it's firing from, and they sort of block the brightness of the ion cannon from their eyes, and it's reminiscent of the Death Star cannon firing, where you have those two guys who, for some bizarre reason, are up right near where the cannon is, and it's a callback to that. And here, with this Y-Wing squadron, there were a lot of callbacks to A New Hope, just in the way they all call in as they're starting the mission. Ahsoka starts talking, Anakin, you know, says, "Cut the chatter," you know, which is a direct callback to a line from A New Hope, and so on and so forth. In fact, I almost want to say there are too many callbacks to the earlier Star Wars stuff. I know people like it, and I know people like to go, "Oh, I remember, you know, that's very similar to, you know, an earlier Star Wars film," but it can actually get to be a bit much, and I do sometimes wonder what the payoff is. Younger kids who have perhaps never seen the earlier films and are starting off with Clone Wars, for example, they won't get it at all. And for the adults at home, again, it's nice to say, "Oh, I remember that from an earlier film," but when it happens again and again and again and again and again in an episode, it's kind of like, yeah, okay, Dave Filoni and co, I get it, you've seen Star Wars. Yes, that line is like in Star Wars. Yes, that camera angle is like in Star Wars. Great. I'm not meaning to be sarcastic, I'm not meaning to be mean about it, but, you know, a few references here and there is fine, but in this episode particularly, I started to notice many, many references. And it can actually be a little off-putting and sort of take you out of the action until your brain is sort of looking out for the references more so than just enjoying the story, if that makes any sense. But anyway, I won't dwell on that. The attack goes forward, and it's quite exciting, actually. And again, no punches are pulled with regard to killing off characters. Members of the squadron are killed off. It's quite tense. It's a great battle, and it's a very enjoyable episode. Maybe not quite as enjoyable as the one before it, but certainly very close. Now, before we move on to the third and final episode, a couple of other notes I've made here. I really enjoyed all three of these episodes, but particularly the first two, because there were no silly kiddie enemies in them. You know, if you've heard my reviews in earlier episodes of Who Wars, you'll know that I'm on the lookout for things that are particularly kiddie and a bit silly. And here, no, we've got General Grievous and we've got Count Dooku as the enemies, two movie enemies from the Star Wars movies, and very tense situations and very scary situations going on. There's no sort of kiddie stuff here at all, which is great. Accent wise for the clones, again, I harp on this almost every time I talk about Clone Wars, there were some Americanisms, some American accented words slipping into the Clone Wars language. Again, people in the US probably don't notice this at all, but they stand out like crazy to me when you've got these people trying to do the Kiwi-like clone accent, and then suddenly all these American-accented words get dropped in here, and they're very disconcerting to someone outside of the US, perhaps viewing this, someone in the Commonwealth particularly, who's more used, perhaps, to UK accents. And one other thing I noted here is there is some really subtle humour, which I appreciate. There's a moving platform, a sort of a train that takes troops and supplies, I guess, up and down the length of the Malevolence, because it's that large a ship. And as he alights from this train at a, I guess you could call it a station within Malevolence, there's a voice in the background saying, "Mind the gap, mind the gap." It's very quiet in the background, you may miss it. It's very funny to have this mind the gap warning in the background of an otherwise tense episode as General Grievous is getting off this train. Anyway, without any further ado, let's talk about the third episode, which is Destroy Malevolence. And here we have Padme and C-3PO come into the action. They're taken hostage by General Grievous. They've been sent into the war zone thinking they're going to something completely different, thinking they're going on some sort of diplomatic mission, and they end up right in the way of the Malevolence. They're taken hostage, and so Anakin and Obi-Wan have to chase down the ship and get on board and save Padme, as well as destroy the Malevolence itself. And this, of course, is very reminiscent of the start of Revenge of the Sith, where Anakin and Obi-Wan have to get on board a big ship, defeat General Grievous, defeat Count Dooku, and save Senator Palpatine. Here, Dooku is in another location, but of course Grievous is on the ship, and they have to be saving Padme. So many, many parallels to the start of Revenge of the Sith. But nonetheless, it's still very, very exciting as the Jedi get on board the ship and have to make this hostage rescue, get off, and then destroy the malevolence. I thought this episode in particular really brought home the bacon. Sometimes when you've got three parts, it can sag in places or it feels a bit disjointed. But these three episodes together really, really work well, I find. And I really enjoyed viewing them. And speaking of callbacks to earlier films, here in this episode, we have General Grievous and his droids surrounding Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan says, "Hello there." And of course, he says this in Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, but here he's saying it in an episode that comes after Revenge of the Sith, but set before Revenge of the Sith, if that makes any sense. And there's also Anakin commenting about spinning being a good trick, which is a line from Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. So some more callbacks. Some of them are fun. I mean, those ones I just mentioned are fun. But sometimes it just gets a little much. Anyway, to close out on this episode, the final frame shows Anakin, Obi-Wan, Padme, C-3PO and R2-D2 being depicted together for the first time. I don't know whether you would have even thought about that when you were watching it. And the reason that's happening is because Episode 1 really lacked C-3PO, while Episode 2 and 3 had them scattered all across different planets. So for the first time in any Star Wars, you see the characters together in one frame. And that's something worth going back and looking at if you didn't notice it the first time. Anyway, what can I say about all three episodes together that I haven't already said? Well, to go back on what I already said, I do think this would have made a great theatrical film instead of what we did get. And I think they're all very, very good and they go together very, very well. If I had to give ratings, I would give the first one, let's see, Rising Malevolence, I'd give it an 8 out of 10, possibly a 9 out of 10. Shadow of Malevolence, meanwhile, maybe a 7 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10. And Destroy Malevolence, probably the same. So we're looking, you know, if I'm being more sort of optimistic, we're looking at 8s and 9s out of 10 for these. I really enjoyed watching them. There was very little to complain about. My biggest complaint about is the callbacks to the earlier films. But I know a lot of people like that. And I know it's a very Star Wars thing to do, even within the original trilogy of movies themselves. Lines are repeated amongst the same characters and among different characters. So it's a Star Wars thing, and I do get that. It just can be a little distracting and a little much when it's overdone in the Clone Wars. But in the scheme of things, that's only a small complaint, and I think it's not too long a bow to draw to say that this would be a great trilogy of episodes to show someone to get them into the Clone Wars. Don't show them the Clone Wars movie. Don't start with Episode 1. Starting in chronological order can be fun, as this run-through that I'm doing on Who Wars has shown. But if you did want to start somewhere in Season 1, these three episodes would be particularly good. You could show these three episodes and then go back to the first episode, which we spoke about in the last episode of Who Wars. That was the ambush episode with Yoda in it primarily, and show them that, and then maybe go forward from there. Yes, this is a very, very good trilogy of episodes. But anyway, I won't go on about it. I think you get the idea that I liked these. If you've seen them, if you have memories of them, why don't you write in and tell me all about it? Hello at whowars.net is the address, or pull out your microphone, record yourself as an MP3 and send that in instead, and we'll use it on the show. All right then, let's move on.
Welcome back to part two. I'm only joined by Darth Vader, aren't I? Now, Darth, what's going on in the new issue of the comic? Things seem to have calmed down a little bit.
This episode is really a back to basics. It's reminding you where we were before myself and Aphra went off on our little adventure.
Now, this isn't one of those issues where we're going to get a bit mixed up, is it?
Don't talk to me about mixed up. You should have seen the trouble when my son brought his girlfriend home.
What are we looking for? This place is dead. It's been dead for weeks. No one alive, nothing inside.
The boy who destroyed the Death Star lived here. He left when his family was slain. There is, perhaps, a trace of his presence.
Ah, Force stuff. Understood. I'll leave you to it. Imperial blasters beneath the burns? Your lot were acting covertly here? Still a little twitchy when the Senate was just fresh in the ground? I guess it's an irony. If the boy was here when the jackboot came down, the Empire would still have a Death Star. But if the family wasn't killed, maybe he'd never have left. Revenge is one hell of a motivator.
You are correct. We are late. Let us move on.
Assuming Mr. Greatest Bounty Hunter in the galaxy has got his grid refs right, this is right where Boba Fett fought the boy.
Wait until signaled. He fended off the bounty hunter. The boy is strong in the Force, but with little or no training. You had 20 years, Obi-Wan. Hiding the boy in the one place I would never return was cunning. But in this, you are a failure. Aphra, I am done. There is nothing here.
Great. Where do you want the bomb? Molecular purge is good. As far as forensic science can tell, no one was ever here. Ever.
As I said.
Now what, Lord Vader?
I must return to my duties. I will have a task for you soon enough. It is a matter of some delicacy.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell?
This is a very different kind of issue of the Darth Vader comic. It's a bridge. It's a recap. It's a reminder. And it's the start of something new. So as you heard, we started in reflective mood, and this is coming after the amazing crescendo of the last issue, which was so huge it combined with the ending of the regular Star Wars comic, if you remember. And now we're on Tatooine, as you heard, with Aphra and Vader, first in the Laz farmstead, and then in the hut of Obi-Wan, trying to get some Force traces of young Skywalker. And then we move on in the comic to, well, what Vader was doing initially. He was on missions for the Imperials as a heavy, sorting out the gangsters of the Outer Rim. If you remember in issue 1, they made a deal with Jabba the Hutt so that the Outer Rim gangsters would start providing stuff with the Imperials in return for favours, shall we say. So we see Vader on one of these missions, and he's there with a Hutt, and it just really is a reminder. And then meanwhile, in a cantina on Suntool, we meet some new, well, maybe not so new characters. We've got a gang of bounty hunters. The first one is a red droid called IG-9. That's right. He's just like his little brother IG-88. He's joined by Bosk, who was one of the bounty hunters in The Empire Strikes Back, you'll remember. The reptilian chap. And they're also with quite a short SWAT character, who I believe is called B-Box. And it basically is a short Mandalorian slash clone trooper type character, which is quite interesting. They're also with Black Chrysanthemum, who is the Wookiee bounty hunter, who again I think goes back to issue 1. So we're coming full circle here. He is fighting in some fighting pits around the back of Cantina, and he's winning. And so the rest of the gang decide to buy him some celebratory drinks when he's finished. And as they're sat there having their drinks, they are joined by another familiar face.
Thank you, Mr. Bebox. Now, Imperial forces have permanently ended the Saw'n'Toul Pride. They're done. Their personal fortune is in transit to its new home in an Imperial vault. I know a little extra. I know exactly how it's being transported, how to circumvent its guards, and, most of all, how to get away. So, gentlemen and violent robots, who wants to be rich?
Hello, Who Wars. I'm here to review Kanan, the Last Padawan, issue number 4 from Marvel, published this week. I think this was a very interesting book. I think it delves into the idea of how someone becomes morally different, as we've discussed so often with this series, is there's a lot of choices which have to be made and a lot of decisions which are put in Caleb Dune's way, who becomes Kanan at some point, which makes him have to make some tough choices. I think this does a great job of kind of showing how that affects him and how he feels that it goes against the Jedi way and how he feels his master looks upon that. I think the most interesting part of this so far is the other character that's become slowly but surely featured in this is the alien known as Kazmir. Kazmir kind of reminds me of Yondu from Guardians of the Galaxy. He's not a nice person, but under the right set of circumstances, he is mindful of those that he trusts and likes. And he obviously likes Caleb because he does a lot for him and protects him. And even when it seemed at the end of the last comic that he was selling him up the river, of course, that wasn't really the goal. The goal was to get the robot and get out on his own and then come back and get Kanan or Caleb after the fact. They do a good job of building this relationship that these two people have. And then, of course, you have this incident with Kanan being captured at the end of the last book. And now we have Kazmir being kidnapped or captured this time by the clone troopers who have come back to try and arrest and execute Caleb. So that now plays out in the series. And depending on, I guess, how far they're taking this, if the next issue is the last book, which it could feasibly be for now, I think they're leading into a good setup to the end. I think there's a lot to like about this book so far, and I think this series is actually really good. I think, as I've said before, I think Wiseman's done a great job with this. I think he's done a very remarkable job of transferring a character from an animated series into a comic book and not lose a beat, and you don't lose a rhythm, even though this character is much younger and obviously is in a totally different space than he is when we see him in Star Wars Rebels. You still get that reminiscent feeling. And I think that's what makes it really great. I think because of that connection to the characters, you feel a lot more united with them in a way, I guess. I think they've ended it off with an interesting kind of cliffhanger. I'd be interested to see if the idea of him going back for this friend of his, if he's actually going to do it, or if he's going to run off. I assume he's going to do it because, the whole thing sort of pointed that way since he got rescued. I'm sure he'll go back and try and save Kazmir. It's interesting to note that Kazmir's last name is Jarrus, which obviously is what Kanan will be taking on later for reasons that we're not quite clear on. So what I find is I'm very interested to see where this is going. It's a very curious book so far. I'm curious to see whether they diverge away from Kazmir at the end of this or if he stays as a part of the storyline going forward. And if Wiseman's planning on doing another series, which it sounded like he was, whether or not that's going to be right on the back of this one or if it's going to be later in the year. But either which way, Kanan number 4, excellent book. Go check it out. It came out Wednesday. Thanks.
My name is Amelia Pond. Since I was a little girl, I've waited 12 years and 4 psychiatrists for a podcast. When I grew up, it finally came. Its name is Who Wars. It's from a galaxy far, far away. They want minds that are bigger on the inside, such as yours. So send something. I sent something, and I've been listening ever since.
Okay, so if you heard episode number 35 and got through to the end of it, where I do my little back page section, I spoke in that episode about my strange and patchy relationship with Doctor Who novels in the past, from, you know, the Target novels of the 70s through to the 90s, to the Virgin New Adventures and Missing Adventures of the 90s, to the BBC's Eighth Doctor Adventures and Past Doctor Adventures of the 90s through to the 2000s, right through to the current series of New Series Adventures, or NSAs, which I decided I would start reading with the Peter Capaldi novels. Now, if you've listened to that section of Who Wars, you'll have a great background to where I'm coming from as I talk about The Blood Cell by James Goss. Now, I guess the first thing to say about The Blood Cell, when I picked it up and started reading, was something I was very surprised by right from the start. And let me read you the first page. Quote, "Do you know who I am?" I said. "One thing you learn, it isn't what prisoners say that tells you most about their guilt. It's their silences." The man said nothing. "Do you know who I am?" I repeated. The man glared at me rudely across the desk. "I know who you think you are," he growled. I pushed the tray of his possessions towards him. The various trinkets rolled and rattled and glistened brightly among the scraps of newspaper. I could see his eyes follow them like a cat's. "These are yours?" I said to him. He nodded. I could see how badly he wanted to hold them. People are like that with objects. Personally, I've never really cared for that kind of thing, but people cram their pockets and their lives with memories of no value to anyone other than themselves. I had nothing like that. Not now. End quote. And of course, the obvious thing there is that the book is written in the first person, which is a very interesting way to write any sort of book, but what an interesting way for me to come back to the Doctor Who novels here in the NSAs to pick up this book, and I'm thinking it'll be, you know, a bit of a page-turner, a bit of a classic romp, perhaps, and suddenly it's this first-person story, and it's not written from the Doctor's perspective or Clara's perspective, it's the governor of a jail. And it's no spoiler for me to say the character he was speaking to there was actually the Doctor. So you do get a lot of interaction between the Doctor and this jail governor through the story and a lot of dialogue from the Doctor. But all the thoughts and the worldview and all of that sort of stuff comes from this person whom we've never met before in Doctor Who. And that's very interesting. So I guess it's fair to say this is ultimately someone else's story, in part by necessity, because someone else is telling it, but also because of what happens in the story, even the stuff that's outside of the narrator's control or outside of his sight, ultimately affects him directly, and even at the very end of the book, we're seeing the results of all that's happened coming together and how it's affected him and his future. I'm trying very hard not to be spoilerific here, as you can tell. Storyline-wise, it's also no spoiler to say that the Doctor is here, locked up in this prison. The Governor is narrating the story, and as you'd expect, the Doctor is just making a total mockery of being locked up in this place, even though it's supposed to be very high security. He even devises a sonic spoon for himself out of a spoon, I guess, from the kitchen or the lunchroom or somewhere like that. And that's quite funny. That's quite Doctor Who. Clara, meanwhile, is a regular visitor, but she's not allowed into the jail. She's not actually not allowed to interact with the Doctor for a lot of the novel. We're given the sense that the TARDIS is taking her back and forth from Earth for these meetings at the jail. And so that ties into the vibe of Series 8 quite nicely, where the Doctor was taking her back to Earth and she was living a bit of her life and then coming back to the TARDIS for another adventure and so on. Whether you actually like that format or not is not up for debate here, but this book certainly ties into that, so it does give you a feeling that this is happening during Series 8, and indeed Danny Pink is mentioned too, but it's not explicit whether Clara has started her relationship with him or not. She mentions perhaps seeing him or perhaps going on a date, but it's not clear as to what part of the relationship they're into at this point. Later in the novel, though, when the Doctor and Clara are working together, once Clara is allowed inside the prison, they're very tight, they're very effective. They're almost like the Doctor and Rose in Series 2 on TV, just not, you know, smug about it, if you can remember back to that sort of relationship. And this is okay on the face of it, but I guess it doesn't quite ring true for the two of them in Series 8, because when I think back Clara was just being mean to the Doctor all of the time, and it didn't feel quite like this at all. But that's only a small quibble. You can sort of imagine the Doctor and Clara being able to act like this, and indeed, the way they act in this novel is the way that I think they might be acting in Series 9 later this year. You know, from everything we've read and everything that's been said so far, you know, the Doctor and Clara have been together for a little while now, and they're really firing on all cylinders. And I think, yeah, the way they are in this book might be more Series 9-ish, but it's not Series 9, it's clearly Series 8. So it's maybe just a little bit ahead of its time. Now, the storyline unfolds in such a way that I think you're almost impatient to learn more, particularly as it's all being told from one person's perspective, so we can't be jumping around to different locations with different characters and learning all sorts of different things. But of course, that's very deliberate, and it lets the story build up to its conclusion. And as an aside, I did like this first-person viewpoint enabling that sort of storytelling, but I really wouldn't like to see it done too often. It's a very specific kind of storytelling. If I think back to the extended universe in Star Wars, those novels, I think there was only one novel in dozens and dozens and dozens of novels that was told in the first person. That was a book called I, Jedi by Mike Stackpole. So even in a big range like Star Wars, first person was done sparingly. I wouldn't like to see it pop up in these Doctor Who books too often, especially as it seems that there's only going to be 3 or 6 of these books every year. I think 6. It would be too much for them to do the first-person shtick more than once every now and then. Maybe once every 5 years might be enough. I don't know. Anyway, getting back to the story, the conclusion to it all was a bit odd. Not in the sense that it was bad or it didn't fit. It was actually quite interesting. But it sort of comes from nowhere and is resolved very, very, very quickly. You know, you're reading this book and turning the pages, and you're more than 3/4 of the way through it, and you still don't know where it's going. And then, you know, I can't say much more without spoiling it, but yeah, you find yourself reading it, and, you know, it's from the governor's perspective and all this stuff, and you're thinking, where's it all going? And then the name of the book will play on your mind all this time. You know, it's called The Blood Cell, and you're thinking, well, they're in a prison, there's cells, but what is the blood cell? You know, we have blood cells in our body. Is it a double meaning? What's going on? And that will play on your mind, and it all doesn't come together until very, very late in the piece. I guess, unlike many Doctor Who novels and TV stories where it's clear what it's all about in the first 5 minutes. You know the name of the story, you watch the first 5 minutes, and you think, oh yeah, that's what this is. Sometimes you even just read the name of a story and you've got a pretty good idea what it's going to be about. You know, there are obvious ones like, I don't know, Daleks in Manhattan. Could the Daleks be in New York City? It's a good guess, you know. Others are a bit more oblique, but generally you know what's going on. Here, you have no idea what the blood cell is until very, very, very late in the piece, and then it's all resolved very, very quickly as well. It's different. I'm not entirely sure whether I liked it. I guess for a rating, then, it's hard to be definitive as well, because this is the first NSA I've read. You know, I never read the Eccleston ones, or the Tennant ones, or the Matt Smith ones, and there've been dozens of those. So comparisons are out of the question. I'd say maybe 3 out of 5 TARDISes, perhaps. It's interesting, it's different, the characters feel, you know, quite good, quite spot on. You know, the Capaldi dialogue in particular is great. But I wasn't reading it thinking, this is absolutely amazing, you know, either. Again, it's hard to say what it's like compared to the next couple of books I'm about to embark on, which is Silhouette by Justin Richards and then The Crawling Terror by Mike Tucker. I mean, this could be Shakespeare compared to those, and I just don't know it. But who knows? So I think I'll stick with a pretty safe 3 out of 5. And before I go, one interesting thing. I'm just opening the book as I speak to you. The book is dedicated to several people. One is Annie Murr for advice about guilt. One is to Ailsa Sladen for being. And then a much longer dedication here is dedicated to Paul Sprague. He loved Doctor Who so much, Doctor Who loved him back. And that name, Paul Sprague, was familiar to me, but I couldn't quite place it. And like I Googled it, and then it all came back to me. Paul Sprague was one of the Big Finish team and passed away some time ago. And the book is dedicated, obviously, to his memory there. So that's very sad, but it did enable me to do that Google search and remind myself of Paul Sprague. And gosh, what a loss there for the Big Finish team. What a loss for Doctor Who fandom in general. So on that downbeat note, I think I'll finish the review there. The Blood Cell by James Goss. It's a 3 out of 5. It's written in the first person. It's very different as a Doctor Who novel. I think I can say that even without reading the next couple. And if you want to give it a go, please do. You can get it now in hardback, which is a very nice way to collect Doctor Who novels. And if you do end up reading it, why not write into Who Wars and let us know what you thought.
Hello, Who Wars. It's Jonathan and Robert here from Cloud City Council. Today, however, we're here to talk to you about the other half of this podcast, Doctor Who. So, we asked Rob if we could do a review of every Dalek episode across both old and new Who. And today, we're here to take on the Daleks in their very first appearance ever in 1963. So, Rob, you had never previously seen this series.
I have not.
Right. Had you watched any older Doctor Who before this?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay, so this is kind of your first introduction. So that's, this is, if you're unfamiliar with the way we work, this is kind of how it goes. I've seen some of it, he hasn't, we kind of talk about it. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of fun because, honestly, we get, because of that experience, we have different experiences with it. I will admit, obviously, I'm a little young to have seen this when it first came out. So I myself only watched it a couple of years ago. So my first experience with Daleks is relatively new as far as the older version goes. My first experience with Doctor Who actually was in the 80s, seeing, I think, possibly the fifth Doctor, but more likely the fourth Doctor on PBS in the U.S., they used to show it up here in Canada, and so we would get snippets of that. And to be honest with you, I was always completely lost because, first of all, it was the 70s version of Doctor Who, and typically it was John Pertwee, he was the third Doctor, so I didn't understand quite what was going on half the time. And, of course, coming out of Star Wars, I always found the older Doctor Who to be kind of lame when I was that age, so it took a long time for me to warm up to the older Doctor Who. But I have to say, watching it back now, I have a lot more respect for it now than I did as a teenager. And I actually quite enjoy a lot of the older Doctor Who stuff I've watched. And I've watched a fair bit, not like obviously everything, because some of it doesn't even exist anymore at the moment. But for what I can watch, I've watched quite a bit. And like I said, I have enjoyed it. So let's go to you, Rob. What was your first impressions of this serial?
At first, I definitely had to start trying to remember that it is not like today's standard. Like you said, it came out quite a bit ago, and it's definitely one of those black and white TV shows. And overall, I don't normally watch those on a daily basis, if ever. So that was the first hurdle I had to overcome, and that took a good 2 or 3 episodes, to be quite honest. So there was that. And then after I got past that part, I was just like, alright, this is okay. It's not, like, great compared to today's stuff.
Yeah, you have to sort of set your mind back. And it's kind of like watching the original series of Star Trek. If you ignore, you know, the really hokey stuff that goes on and just kind of watch the story, I think it's better than if you get obsessed with, oh my gosh, look at that, look at this, that doesn't look right, oh look at how messed up their history is, ha ha ha, you know, that kind of thing, right? Because like World War III happens in like 1980 something, mm-hmm. And you know, all those weird and wonderful things that they talk about that obviously didn't happen. And I always find that I think the difference for me, I guess, between Star Trek and Doctor Who in that respect is that because I watched Star Trek as a much younger person, it's kind of easier to set that aside in a way that I had more, like you, I had to really hunt initially with this one because it's black and white. And I've always thought that that special effects in the 60s were helped by black and white. And that was one of the reasons why when they go color, they look really bad in the 70s, is because they're still kind of used to the black and white style of doing things. And what they forget is it doesn't look good in color at all. And because, you know, like even the Daleks, like the Daleks that we have here actually have color to them, but you never see it except for in pictures. Because these Daleks actually have blue balls on them.
Hmm.
But you don't know that at the time because all you see is gray on gray. But that's kind of the design style they had. And it, you know, I always found initially my first impression as a kid with the Daleks is I always thought they were lame because I never understood the plungers. I always thought those were really weird, but I could never understand what they would do with them, right? It's like, why has he got a plunger on the end of his hand?
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing with that is we, at least for me, I have new Daleks. And these are, this is the first time that anyone has seen them. And just seeing what they were about, what they first envisioned them, is just like, mm-hmm. they're only going to be around for these 7 episodes. So it'll be interesting to see coming up in the next set that we watch how they progressed from where they were to where they're going.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's a very interesting dynamic on how, I think what it is, what it comes down to is, much like anything else, necessity is a bit of the mother of invention. When this particular serial came out, Doctor Who was mildly liked, but it was certainly not popular at this point. And then this came out, and I think you're right. I think initially it was meant for a one-shot kind of thing, in part because the guy who was producing it wasn't enamored with, as he called it, the bug-eyed aliens. And, of course, these guys definitely fit in that category. And I think the thinking from Sidney Newman and the others was that, okay, well, we'll put this out here and we'll see what happens. You know, we'll either swim, you know, it was either going to sink or swim. And it definitely didn't sink, obviously. And the Daleks became hugely popular, like I think way more popular than they ever imagined them to be. Sort of like Boba Fett. It's actually a really good combination. If you look at Boba Fett, Boba Fett was a throwaway character put in Empire Strikes Back who suddenly became popular enough that we've now had him in 3 movies and in numerous cartoons, and we'll probably get his own movie at some point. It's just, it's one of those things where you put something out, you think it'll be cool, you're not sure, and all of a sudden it explodes like a viral video. You know, it was kind of the 60s version of Gangnam Style, which is a really, really awful comparison. Sorry, mm-hmm. sorry. Apologize. But it's that, that's kind of how it went. I mean, it went, kids loved them in that era. And so they made, I mean, this was the first time the BBC ever did like marketing to them. So they came out with, you know, toys and all this other stuff that, you know, they themselves had never done before. But yeah, without the Daleks, I don't know that Doctor Who survives. That's how important this serial was to them. And you're right. It was definitely built around the idea this was sort of a one-shot thing. They find them, they leave them, they're dead, bye-bye. And with some aliens that you meet in Doctor Who, that's the way it works. But then if they're really successful, like the Angels and like Cybermen and like so many others, they'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be dead, 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 and somehow magically return the Master. comes to mind, or Missy in this occasion, very much that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cool. What did you think of the acting? I guess that would be another thing. I'm trying to curious to see what you think of that 60s style.
I wasn't opposed to it. Mm-hmm. A part of it seemed a little forced. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you're doing something like this, I imagine it's going to be that way, but overall it was pretty good for the time, I would say.
Yeah. I think the only part that I found, I'll admit, annoying watching it was Susan screaming all the time. you know, when she was running through the forest and she was screaming at every single, it's just like, oh my gosh, come on. But I think that comes down to the ideas that they had, which was very misogynistic at the time. And
yeah,
the
you definitely had that.
Yeah, so you've got, you know, like the girls aren't supposed to be expected to be the action heroes type thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the original theory was with Doctor Who was it was Ian Chesterton's show, and Doctor Who, the Doctor, was just sort of the side character. He was like the supporting character, and it was only later when they sort of realized, oh, no, no, it's the Doctor that's the important one. Mm-hmm. And so he was supposed to do all the action, and he was supposed to be the tough guy. And so what's the first thing they do in this serial? But they knock his legs out from under him, and he flops around like a fish and falls over when he has one pins and needles foot. So that kind of stuff was a little like, okay, sure, I can set my level of acceptance aside. But I thought overall, though, it made good use of the characters. I thought they were all kind of given their bit to do. And I think they developed a reasonable plot in that time allowance they had. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like a movie-length thing that's fit over 20 episode or 20-minute episodes over 7 weeks. I mean, it's hard to imagine that basically you have what amounts to a Big Bang Theory-length show coming out weekly, and you have to wait till the next week to watch the next episode. In this era of instant gratification and binge watching, and, you know, where most dramas are an hour, that must have just been excruciating for people. Especially when the other thing I found funny, and it's something I've had to kind of get realize and get used to, is that, of course, they do this massive recap at the start. And when you're binge watching these things, it's like, oh, I just saw this. Why are we doing this again? And you're looking up going, well, if it was a week later, I can kind of see why they would have done this. Because people would have forgotten. And one of the things you really notice about this as well is the fact that they recorded this on video as opposed to on proper film meant that the quality had degraded quite badly with this particular copy. And, of course, this is one of the many almost lost. I think this one is one of the few that they had all of, unlike most of the rest of them. But still, I mean, the starting bit of it's really rough. So I almost wonder if it would have been a better episode to watch back on original release, it wouldn't look quite so rough. So it may have shown it off a little bit better. I mean, let's be honest, it was kind of aimed in a way to be sort of a cheap sci-fi thing, so it may not have been, but I just wondered about that because there was points where things were a little too black, and I don't know if that's the copy we have or what, but I thought it was interesting. I mean, some of the things that they put in place here with the Daleks are interesting, like they're magnetically powered, so they can't leave their city because that's where all the magnets are.
They need radiation to survive.
Yeah, they need radiations to survive. Sorry, spoilers.
That was my favorite part. It's like, yeah, really?
Yeah.
Definitely a one-shot.
Yeah, the radiation's the only thing keeping them alive. Oh, no, they killed themselves curing it. I think my other favorite to that is when they knock them over. at the end, and you're just like, oh, right, it's like, you know, Tin Man sort of stuff. That was really, the one thing I will say that was really cool with this is you had the idea they put in there that there was something living in it, that it wasn't just purely a robot, which would have been sort of the go-to for a lot of people. And I think that's something that Doctor Who does pretty well, is that they do have robots, but for the most part, even the metal people are still humanoid for some reason, and there's still a justification as to why they're part machine and man. Of course, in the case of the Daleks, they're machine and Scrooge. But I thought that was really interesting how it was even back then they had set that idea up. Obviously, there will be some hand-waving later in our series when we start to watch things like Genesis of the Daleks, where they rewrite some of the history that we have here. But yet, you know, it's done in such a way that it doesn't feel forced. Well, I think that's a pretty good roundup of the first serial. And the next one we will be watching will be the Dalek Invasion of Earth. And we will get to that the next time we have a chance. So from us for now, we'll see you later.
Take care, everyone.
Well, folks, here we are at the end of the 37th Who Wars. My thanks, as always, to the team for producing such great content for the show and for you out there to listen to. If you do enjoy listening to it, why not consider dropping us an iTunes review? It seems to be the thing people do the least. If other podcasts are also to be believed, it would just mean so much to us and would help other people find us on iTunes if you could just fire up iTunes and just throw in a little review, you know, even if it's just a line or two on why you like the show. It would be great. Of course, you can always write us an email to hello@whowars.net or record an MP3 and we'll play it on the show. But that's enough spruiking about that. We did have some feedback based on show 36, and in particular my comment at the end of the show about the possible oversaturation of Star Wars, by which I mean we're at a point where there's all these Star Wars movies in the works, there's the TV series going on, Rebels, there's a few other bits and bobs around the place. I'm thinking if there's going to be anything else announced to come out in the next, you know, 8 to 10 years, we may be getting just a little bit oversaturated on it. Anyway, you can hear my wider thoughts if you go back to episode 36, if you've not heard those. Someone who did hear them, though, is John, or Jonna Holler, on Twitter, if you'd like to look him up. And he says, "Hello, good point on oversaturation. I was thinking this too. Won't there be a period where we will have 3 Star Wars films in 1 year or 13 months? I don't think any other franchise would try this. Marvel gets away with it, perhaps because of variety. James Bond had 2 in 1 year, but they were non-canon." And I'll just stop here. What he's referring to is, I think it was 1967, there was a Sean Connery James Bond film came out. I just can't think of its name. And also Casino Royale with David Niven playing James Bond came out in the same year. And that's the non-canon movie that he's referring to. And yes, just briefly, I do think Marvel gets away with it because of the variety. There will be some variety in the Star Wars releases because these standalone or anthology films, as people like to call them, will have different topics and be looking at different things. But I do think in general, Star Wars is Star Wars, and particularly to the casual viewers, which do make up the majority of the people who, you know, pay for tickets, there could be a bit of Star Wars fatigue coming up. There was a bit of Star Wars fatigue around the time of the prequels, and they were coming out every 3 years. So we'll just have to wait and see on that. In terms of 3 films in 1 year or 13 months, I'm not sure about that. Certainly some will come in within a year of each other. I'm not sure if we'll manage to pull off 3 in 1 year, though. I'm not sure. Anyway, the email goes on. "I'm sure they know what they're doing, but what about people not into it? You only have to talk to a non-sports fan during Olympics or the Football World Cup to get an idea of how irritated they could be. So what, you might think, but fans could be viewed as mindless sheep being taken advantage of, which we're not. The 50th anniversary of Doctor Who was great, as the extra content was lots of little things that didn't outstay its welcome. Ultimately, I think if you create a good product, people will enjoy it, but people only have so much money, don't they? Thanks from John." And look, I've already had a little comment halfway through the email, but yes, I think you're right. I think it's the people who aren't the fans, who, as I say, do make up the majority of the ticket buyers. They can get irritated. They can get over this sort of stuff. And it will just be interesting to see what happens. Again, I reiterate what I said in that back page piece. I don't think we're at the point where we are oversaturated. If this is their plans for the next, you know, 8 to 10 years, that's great. But, you know, if next month they say, "And here's another 3 films we're going to put out," I'll be quite happily stating that I think that might be too much. I really do. And there are fans out there, obviously, who think I'm crazy for saying this because they would watch a new Star Wars film every day of the week, or at least they think they would. But I'm not sure what the reality would actually be if there were such things as, you know, Star Wars movies every day of the week. Anyway, to round out this episode, I do have a mini sort of back page rant to talk about now. And it ties into San Diego Comic-Con. We had Margaret earlier on the show chatting with Kate about her experiences there. And one thing that happened was at San Diego Comic-Con, the makers of the movie Suicide Squad, funnily enough talking about comic book movies, they put together a trailer that was just for the people at San Diego Comic-Con. And it got leaked. and, you know, they wrote a snotty message that, oh, this was just meant for the people at San Diego Comic-Con, so fine, we're going to put it out on the internet. It wasn't meant to go out like this. And whether you think that was a marketing ploy or not, it's this whole vibe of things being exclusive at San Diego Comic-Con that is absolutely driving me up the wall. And I spoke to a few of you out there on Twitter about this probably a week or so ago now. And I'm reminded of Doctor Who doing it for the 50th anniversary. They put together a trailer and it was exclusive to San Diego Comic-Con. And then after Comic-Con, the expectation was, okay, well, the rest of the world will get to see this, won't we? And we didn't. There was one very, very bad video version of it that someone had done on a camera phone that I saw, and it just wasn't even worth watching. But it's this attitude that a room of people at San Diego Comic-Con is worth marketing to in such a way that you wouldn't show something ever to the rest of the world that I find quite bizarre, obscene. You know, it's very strange. You know, I don't know what the mindset is behind this. That, oh, we've got this wonderful footage or this wonderful trailer or whatever it might be. We're just going to show it to these people, these few hundred people or thousand people, whatever it might be, in whatever particular room they're in. And then that's it. No one else is ever going to see it. You know, you can talk about word of mouth, and these people might get on Twitter and say to their 50 followers or 100 followers, oh, I saw the new Doctor Who trailer, it was good. And people go, oh, great. When can I see it? Well, you can't. Oh, okay. Is that really generating buzz? I don't think that it is. You know, and I must say, in many cases, this stuff that is for San Diego Comic-Con does eventually come out, or a version very similar to it does come out later that week, later that month, or at least very soon afterwards. But there are examples where it doesn't. That Doctor Who example is one. It seems like this Suicide Squad one, if, you know, such a version wasn't released around San Diego Comic-Con, they wouldn't have actually put out a trailer, at least if you believe the company line. And I actually do, in that case, I do think it was a genuine leak and they responded to it. But, yeah, this vibe that, you know, showing a few hundred or a few thousand people something is great marketing, I think, is ridiculous. Not even all the people in San Diego who want to go to San Diego Comic-Con can get in. Not all the people in the US who want to go to San Diego Comic-Con can get in. Not all the people in the world who want to travel over to San Diego for San Diego Comic-Con can get in. So you have these massive markets of people who are really interested in your product, would really like to see what you're doing, and you not only won't show them, you actually make a thing about it, like, yeah, we're showing it to these few hundred people and you're not seeing it. You know, what a way to piss off fans, if I can be so frank. Man, it's just strange and annoying. I don't understand it. The people I spoke to out there on Twitter, you guys, you didn't understand it. It's weird. It doesn't generate good word of mouth. It does piss people off. It makes no sense. You know, I'm all for putting out a trailer or footage or whatever to some people in a room and saying, hey, welcome to San Diego Comic-Con, here's a panel, and look, we're going to play this video. Wacky-doo, isn't that great? And then later that day or the next day, it's on the internet for everyone to see. Because 99.99999% of the fans of that content are out here in the real world, not, you know, not squished into some, you know, smelly theatre up against, you know, a few hundred sweaty geeks. The majority of people who are interested aren't at San Diego Comic-Con. Yes, they may have fought for their tickets. Yes, they may have lined up for hours. But they're nowhere near the majority of the audience. They're nowhere near the majority of people you want to reach for good word of mouth. It's, again, just bizarre that, you know, Hollywood has decided, oh yeah, if we show exclusive stuff to a few hundred people or a few thousand people, it's wonderful marketing. No. No, Hollywood, it's really not. It's actually quite stupid. Anyway, if you have any thoughts on San Diego Comic-Con and that sort of exclusive content that goes on, why not write in and let us know your thoughts. hello@whowars.net if you want to send an email or record yourself as an MP3. And we'll play it on the show. That's it for episode 37. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening through right to the end. As always, I'm Rob Irwin. Take care of yourselves out there. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time in episode 38.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.